Good afternoon. We are here to celebrate Ann Coughlin. Let me give you some biographical information. Ann has an undergraduate degree from Tufts, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, etc. An MA in English Literature from Columbia and a JD from NYU, where she graduated at the top of her class and was managing editor of the Law Review and won a award bestowed by the faculty on the outstanding student. She then clerked for Judge John Newman of the Second Circuit and then for Justice Lewis Powell. After clerking, she practiced first with Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York City and then with Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin in D.C. And between the two of those places had a substantial practice career. Then went into teaching at Vanderbilt, visited with us in 94-95 and joined our faculty full-time in 1996. As a full professor, she became the O.M. Vickers Professor in 2003, which is the appointment that we celebrate somewhat belatedly today. Now, the law school publishes a magazine which I encourage you to look at if you get a chance. It comes out once a year. It's called the Virginia Journal, and the Virginia Journal will have a profile of three faculty members. Ann was profiled a few years ago, and the headline for the essay on her was "At the Intersection of Criminal Law and Feminist Jurisprudence," which struck me, Ann, as both inaccurate and rather pallid. There is a conventional body of understanding that lies at the intersection of criminal law and feminist jurisprudence. For example, the law of rape figures very prominently in the feminist critique of the criminal law, and the feminist critique focuses on various elements in the traditional law of rape, much of which has now been superseded, various elements which are disadvantageous to women victims and in many cases helpful to male defendants, and they have been those elements, things like the spousal exclusion, things like corroboration requirements, the requirement in traditional rape doctrine that there be resistance by the victim in some jurisdictions, resistance to the utmost. All these are features of the traditional law of rape, which have been subject to scathing and justified feminist criticism. Other elements of the criminal law that have been similarly criticized, enforcement particularly of domestic violence, the marital coercion doctrine in the law of duress, and today, of course, battered women's syndrome is an issue of importance. Ann Coughlin understands all these issues perfectly well and has contributed significantly to our understanding of them. I am better situated than some to know that because I'm the direct beneficiary of her work on a casebook, which we do together along with Peter Lowe, see in the back of the room, and also Richard Bonney. When Ann joined that casebook in 1997, she added a chapter which had not previously been there at all on sexual assault, and she also added material on the battered women's syndrome. The second edition, which came out in 2004, treats those and a variety of other topics that are connected to feminist jurisprudence far more elaborately and sensitively and well. But the feminist critique of criminal law has become conventional. It's shared by almost everyone, certainly everyone who is a serious scholar of the subject. And Ann Coughlin's understanding of what lies at the intersection of these two great fields is anything but conventional. It is, in fact, intellectually daring. Turn again for an example to the law of rape. The conventional understanding is that the traditional law of rape embodies notions of male privilege and right and denigration of the interest of women. All that is perfectly true as far as it goes. It doesn't go nearly far enough. Functionally, today, rape doctrine distinguishes sexual assault from consensual, and therefore, in the eyes of the law, certainly in your eyes, entirely legitimate sexual activity. Historically, however, rape doctrine did not make that distinction. Historically, consensual sex outside marriage was independently criminal, either as adultery or fornication. Viewed against the backdrop of extramarital sex being criminal independently of any assault or predation, the elements of the traditional crime of rape take on an entirely new meaning. Or rather, they recover a meaning not in fact entirely new, but simply lost to our collective vision. And that is that traditional rape doctrine did not separate the crime of rape from legitimate consensual sex. It separated the crime of rape, for which only the man would be liable, from the crimes of adultery and fornication, for which the man and the woman could be held criminally liable. And thus, in its historical context, traditional rape doctrine was not only concerned with defining the man's guilt, but also concerned, and perhaps equally concerned, with excusing the woman's criminality. Now, these ideas, which I hasten to add are no one's ideas of a normative agenda for the law today, but these ideas, as an explanation of why the law looks the way it looks and where it came from and what kind of intellectual baggage is embedded in that traditional doctrine, these ideas are intellectually radical. They turn conventional understanding on its head, and they try to recover from the past what seems to us today a shockingly different and new understanding of a particularly recalcitrant body of law. And these are the features that I identify most prominently in Ann's scholarship. Originality, sharp unconventionality, and what is implicit in those terms, courage, because she writes in entirely new directions about topics that are the subject of passionate debate and deep sensitivity. Today we celebrate Ann's appointment as the O.M. Vickers Professor of Law. Mr. Vickers was an attorney, prominent attorney in the state of Virginia, who died in 1946. His grandson is Carl Smith. Carl Smith is now also dead, was on the Board of Visitors. He was on the Darden School Foundation Board of Trustees. He is the donor behind the Carl Smith Field, which surrounds and somehow occupies the precincts of the Scott Stadium, where the David Harrison also lurks. It just makes me realize the athletic department is more sophisticated than the law school about naming opportunities, or we would be in the Mort Kaplan et al. Pavilion. And Carl Smith's wife, Hunter, after his death, was the major figure behind, financially and politically, behind the marching band. Now, I have no doubt that these associations are gratifying to Anne, given her continuing intellectual engagement with the finance theorist at Darden and her fanatical support of big-time football and her surprising taste for marching bands. But there is, in fact, a more serious and important connection between Ann Coughlin and the Vickers chair. The legacy of Mr. Vickers to his family was not that he was a successful lawyer. I think that's true enough, but it's not what they cared about, and it's not why they created the position. They cherished him as an ethical, high-minded, public-spirited lawyer, one who took to his heart the responsibilities of the lawyer as an officer of the court and as a citizen of the community. The appreciation of their grandfather by the Vickers family was not of a professional who made a good living and started them on the road to wealth. I think, in fact, the wealth came later. It was an appreciation of their grandfather as a model of character and integrity and public service. It is those qualities they honored by creating the Vickers chair, and it is those qualities that we honor here today. Institutions develop their own culture. They have traditions, values, personality. If you will, they have character. Institutional success in building a strong culture, and more importantly, in building good character, depends on the acts and choices of individuals. And the contributions that individuals make to the collective good of an institution's character often go unnoticed or at any rate underappreciated even by those who benefit from them. Frankly, this is something I see more clearly as dean than I did before. And in the 6 years that I have occupied that vantage point, no one has contributed more to the culture of this institution. No one has contributed more to the character of the law school than Ann Coughlin. When events and incidents occur that some members of the community find hurtful, as inevitably will be the case, Ann Coughlin is there. She is there with sympathy for those who want it, with encouragement for those who need it, and with caring for us all. She is there with advice and wise counsel, advice that sacrifices neither warmth nor objectivity. Ann manages to be passionately supportive and dispassionately impartial at the same time. She manages to bring complete empathy to those who are troubled while continuing to see clearly how others will react. And she is therefore the wisest of counselors and the best of friends. And there are here today and throughout the building and indeed throughout our community of graduates, hundreds of students and colleagues and deans for whom you are the face of Virginia. You are the person who embodies what we value here. You are the person who steers us toward our better selves and helps us see in each other the goodness and charity that you see in us all. Ladies and gentlemen, Ann Coughlin.
Thank you, Dean Jeffries, for that kind and wonderfully generous introduction. I, too, want to pause and say a special word of thanks to the family of Mr. Vickers, who so generously created and funded this professorship in his name. I'm deeply honored to hold it, and I thank the dean and the entire community for your support for my research and teaching. Some of you may know it's literally a dream come true for me to be here. And so I thank you from the bottom of my heart. My family is here today as well. They feel the same way, and so I'll share their gratitude with you also. When I was in the planning stages for the lecture, especially when I was confronting the most vexing question of all, what on earth should I talk to you about today, I kept in mind a conversation that I had with Leslie Kendrick a couple of years ago. Some of you will know Leslie. She is a 2006 graduate of the law school. She is currently clerking for Judge Wilkinson. Next year, she's going to clerk for Justice Souter. And the year after that, she's coming back here to join our faculty and to be part of the UVA law school community. She gave me the following perspective. We were talking about chair lectures generally, and she said to me that she thought that chair lectures were coming out parties for professors. And if you know Leslie, you're going to know that she was aware of, and indeed she intended, all the sort of delicious complications that are implied by the phrase coming out. But in the conversation, she also made it plain that when she came to one of these affairs as a student, she was looking for the professor to make a public declaration about his or her research agenda, to stake out their own scholarly place in the law school's intellectual community, and of course in the broader community, legal academy beyond. So as I hope you'll see, I've tried to take Leslie's analogy to heart, at least to some extent. She gave me a very tall order, one that I can't fill completely. But what I did decide to do is to go ahead and take a risk and come out and describe for you some work in progress, to debut for you some new scholarship, a scholarship that is not yet finished. That the project is unfinished may be of a disadvantage to you. My conclusions aren't firm, they aren't fixed, and you might prefer for me to give you some clear solutions at the end of the talk. I also hope that you'll find the open-endedness, the tentative and speculative character of my observations to be a benefit, as I see it, because it gives you a place in the conversation, right? I really welcome, invite, and in fact need your thoughts comments and questions. The essay on which I'm working starts with a small observation about routine but very important police practices. And here my aim is to focus on the tactics that police interrogators are using to elicit confessions from criminal suspects. The observation that directly motivates the essay is narrower still, as my main focus is on some of the strategies that are used by police officers to interrogate suspects in rape cases. My hope, my intuition, as I was saying to the dean when we were coming down, is that this small observation will have some large payoffs. And I want you to try to keep some of these larger themes and questions in mind. There are normative, political, and empirical questions that I will need to address in future projects. So let's try to keep these in mind as we move forward into the remarks. But as we study routine police practices, as we look at what the police are doing when they go around developing, say, probable cause for a search or a seizure, or creating their interrogation techniques and strategies, we find ourselves confronting some very significant questions about the productive role that police play in shaping first the facts of the cases on which our criminal adjudication system works, and also, I think I ultimately may argue, the law that they are ostensibly enforcing. So they play both a productive role both in the fact arena as well as in the lawmaking arena. And so one of my fundamental questions, what is and what should be the connection between police interrogation strategies and the facts that emerge in the form of confessions to crimes? Likewise, what is the connection between police investigatory practices and the meaning of the substantive criminal law? In criminal law classes, in first-year criminal law, we often find ourselves wondering, who is the audience for these substantive commands? Who precisely is the target of the substantive prohibitions? And so, too, I think we want to begin to ask, who is it that controls the meaning of these prohibitions and precisely how? We have legislators and statutes. We have judges and court opinions. We have police and their interrogation scripts. There are many official voices, in other words, speaking to us about the scope and the content of the substantive criminal law. Are these voices speaking harmoniously? Should they be? If they are not, if we find places where the messages seem to be in conflict, what do these conflicts mean? What problems and opportunities do they present? Why do they occur? And then, of course, whose interests do they and their resolutions serve? My title for the lecture aims to hint at these broader themes, and I want to keep them hovering in the background, as I say, as I turn to my much more prosaic observations. If you're fans of Charles Dickens, as I am, you'll know that I borrow my title from a wonderful passage in Our Mutual Friend, which, among other things, is a first-rate detective novel. So if you don't read Dickens as a detective writer, you should. You got to. So the specific line I have in mind is used by one of Dickens' wonderful characters, a woman named Betty Higden. She's a deserving widow in penurious circumstances. She's really fallen on hard times. But she has taken in, again, pardon the old-fashioned expression, a slow-witted boy named Sloppy. I tend to think I'm Sloppy today. So she's taken in Sloppy, and she uses the following phrases to praise him. She says, "I ain't, you must know, much of a hand at reading writing hand, though I can read my Bible and most print. And I do love a newspaper. You mightn't think it, but Sloppy is a beautiful reader of the newspaper. He do the police in different voices." And you also may know that until Ezra Pound persuaded him otherwise, T.S. Eliot had selected this line, "He do the police in different voices," as the title for his poem, The Wasteland. Now, my husband Mark is here, and he's usually my Ezra Pound. He hasn't yet tried to get his hand on my title, but if he does, I think I'm going to argue that this line, if good enough for Dickens and originally for Eliot, will be good enough for me and this small project. Okay, so police interrogations, confessions, they raise big questions, they raise very big themes, ones that are explored in rich interdisciplinary literatures, including literature, novels, fiction, and poetry. But today you'll be thanking heavens. I have much smaller fish to fry. My initial essay, the one I'm about to describe, focuses on interrogation tactics in rape cases, and it arises from a very specific observation that I made when I was reading old police interrogation manuals as I was preparing to teach Miranda versus Arizona in my criminal procedure course. And what I noticed is this. All of the manuals, all of the expert manuals that I've looked at, exhort interrogators to use victim-blaming stories as the method for procuring confessions in rape cases. Now, upon reading these recommendations, I'll share some of them with you in specific detail in a few minutes. My first thought was, for me, a very obvious one, alas, after John's lovely description of how unconventional I am. I had the very conventional feminist thought, was, oh dear, you know, feminism hasn't made a dent at all on the interrogation room. And then as I continued to think about this problem, to follow the observation through the literature over a several-year period, I realized that the problem, if indeed there is a problem, isn't simply that feminist consciousness hasn't penetrated as far as the police confessional. The more interesting problem is that the substantive criminal law may not be making an impact there either. In recent decades, and here I want to emphasize, during the precise period of time that we in the world of criminal procedure associate with the so-called Miranda Revolution, right? So in that period of time, in those short decades, legislators across the country have moved to eliminate victim blaming from the substantive criminal law and to sharply limit the use of victim blaming as an evidentiary strategy by defense lawyers. Many of the victim blaming stories ostensibly are foreclosed by formal definitions of rape found in contemporary penal codes, and they also are forbidden by reforms embodied in rape shield laws. And as you can imagine, this picture is very complicated. What is the objective and the likely effect of these reforms? It's uncertain. It may be fair to say that the ultimate objective is to scrub some forms of victim blaming from the juridical canon, right? And then ultimately, one would hope, from the popular stockpile of stories as well. Maybe there's some theory like that. But in any event, the substantive law has been reformed quite dramatically. But then when you turn to the law of criminal procedure or criminal procedure spaces, the interrogation room specifically, what you find in this intimate space where the heroes and the villains, cops and accused criminals sit down together, what they do is to swap stories about female culpability for sexual violence. So that's the basic observation, and I'm going to give you a little bit more detail about these stories in a few minutes, because I would like to invite you to think hard about them, about their meaning. My objectives for the project, the ultimate project, are threefold. First, I aim to consider what interrogation stories may have to teach us about the character of police investigations as a device for recovering historical truth. We believe that interrogations are a practice that gives us access to the true answers of who done it, how, when, where, and why, right? That's what we think. And my initial reaction from reading interrogation stories is to suggest that we need to pay a lot more attention than we currently do in either the criminal procedure literature, certainly in the substantive literature, to the question of precisely how it is, what are the rhetorical strategies that police interrogators use to create the truth that they find. So in the project, what I think I am going to argue is that the confessional room is a space where truth is produced by the interrogator's strategic use of narratives, stories about guilt and innocence. Confessions aren't merely elicited from suspects. Rather, they are actively created by very specific plot lines that investigators offer up to suspects to get them talking and keep them talking until, of course, they ultimately sign on to a confession. Now, if that's so, I want to be very clear up front. I am not in any way, shape, or form intending or desiring to criticize the police for using interrogation stories. To the contrary, as you all know, within law, narrative is a conventional, perhaps the conventional way for arriving at truth. This is what lawyers do in the adversarial system. They take the same set of facts and provide very different stories, very different plots, and we let the system sort out which of the stories is true. So the police are doing precisely what other legal actors, including many of you, will do if you litigate. Instead, my suggestion is, again, at the outset, just let's think carefully. What are the stories that the police are telling? What plot lines are we authorizing them to produce in the confessional room? Again, stories that end up producing the truth upon which the system acts. Second, and very closely connected to this first goal, I hope to contemplate the connection between rape interrogation stories and the movement to reform the law of rape. As I mentioned, over the last several decades, most jurisdictions have revised their rape codes, some very dramatically, moving in the direction of punishing not only sex that is procured by violence, but also any sex that is otherwise non-consensual. And as the substantive law changes, I wonder, should we not see the police starting to tweak the plot lines of their interrogation stories? We would expect that they would need to develop, in other words, new facts to satisfy the elements of the revised statutes. If we're not seeing those changes in the interrogation stories, why not? What might this have to tell us again about the character of reformers' objectives? Their links to the need for changes in policing as well as changes in the law and the books. And then another question, and one that's broader still, is to begin studying the role that the police play, as I said, in fixing the meaning of the substantive criminal law. What do the police make of the statutory definitions on the books, and again, how is it that they make it? So in any event, those are some of the broader questions. Another small set of preliminary matters that I want to mention. As we move forward into this project, you need to keep your eye on the police confessional and the sources of law that surround it. But I argue don't confine it or regulate its practices, determine its methodology very closely. So for criminal procedure scholars, criminal lawyer scholars, interrogations occur in a very interesting and important institutional space. It's a space that falls right in the middle of the substantive law on the one side and the law of criminal procedure on the other. And I want to be really clear, the space is not limited to the interrogation room, right? In some sense, I'm talking about all of the spaces or all of the investigatory work that the police do. There are plenty of people working there, but the space does tend to be one that eludes the law. It's a place where, as lawyers, we say policy judgments work, not the law. And again, I want to be clear, leaving the place to policy is probably the correct judgment. It just seems to me that lawyers, legal scholars, lawmakers have to evaluate the policy critically because, among other things, it yields up to us the bodies of the human subjects upon which the criminal law does its terrifying work. So we really need to investigate what is it that's going on there. And what's been absolutely fascinating to me, so far as I can tell, is no one in the law review literature has paused to look at this question. And I'm here to invite you to help me fill in this lacuna and figure out what on earth to say. The other thing I want to say, so I say it's a space where policy does its work, but I also want to be clear, there's law here, so let's think briefly about what sorts of legal guidance is present in this space. When the police are running around looking for physical clues, when they are apprehending suspects, when they are trying to persuade perpetrators to snitch on themselves or roll over on their confederates, they are guided by both the substantive criminal law and by the rules of criminal procedure. But the guidance turns out to be fairly minimal. First, as a practical matter, and it's again here that there's a big gap in the literature, police investigators must have the content of the substantive criminal law at least in the backs of their minds, right? Without the penal code, they would have no job to do. They must be keeping an eye on the statutory elements of crimes they are detecting, and specifically on the evidence that they need to find in order to help prosecutors prove those cases beyond a reasonable doubt if they ever come to trial. So as I said, in first-year criminal law, we often wonder, you know, who exactly are the consumers for substantive criminal law? Who is in the audience? It surely must be the case, even if lay folks don't know anything about the law on the books, the police do. They're keeping an eye on the statutory developments, they know the law, and they notice when it changes. So unquestionably, we're going to see the marks of the substantive criminal law on investigatory practices. And we also have the sense, again, coming out of criminal procedure courses, you're going to have the very strong sense that when they're investigating crimes, the police are constrained by the rules of criminal procedure, right? And here, of course, what I'm thinking of are the rules that govern searches and seizures and the rules that guide the taking of confessions from suspects. If these rules are working in the empirical way that the Supreme Court seems to imagine when it's designing them, the rules have been calibrated to provide incentives for proper police behavior. And if that's so, if that assumption is correct, at a minimum, the police must follow these rules and the changes in the rules for those rules to be working to supply a meaningful prod for their conduct. So again, both bodies of law hover here, but the more I went into the project, the more it occurred to me that neither provides very much guidance to the police or to the rest of us about what exactly these rhetorical practices in the interrogation room should consist of. Now, when you think about the substantive criminal law, and again, here I could be completely wrong, so if I am, I would love to hear from you. It seems to me that the substantive law really doesn't dictate what the police are supposed to be doing as a practical matter when they're investigating crimes. They provide only very general guidance, something along these lines. You know, officers, you are sworn to uphold the law, so get on out there and bring down arsonists, dope dealers, murderers, rapists, robbers. You know, that's it. It's just very general precatory advice. Just go out and do it, at least insofar as the legal literature is concerned. We pay absolutely no attention to this question about the communication between the police and the substantive criminal law. And then, too, though the law of criminal procedure speaks much more directly to police investigative activity, that law also turns out to provide minimal guidance. And as important for my purposes in terms of the place for this project in the legal scholarship on policing, the rules of criminal procedure turn out to be based on largely unstated and unexamined assumptions about the connections between procedure and substance, about the role that the police play in excavating the historical facts of a crime, bringing guilty offenders to justice, and thereby vindicating the meaning and function of the criminal sanction. For example, think for a minute about the rules for forming probable cause. And this is an example that I'll turn to at the end of the essay. Think about the rules for forming probable cause and the way in which the standard in Gates explicitly directs the police to follow the substantive law. Okay, before officers may search or seize people and stuff, they have to conclude not only that things look pretty fishy, that's probable cause, right? Things look pretty fishy. They also have to conclude that things look pretty fishy in one of the precise ways condemned by the substantive law. So the paradigm clearly assumes that police know and follow the substantive law. Of course, their primary job is to ferret out facts, but not any old facts. Instead, their job is to find facts that tend to show that a violation may have occurred. Again, this is very obvious and basic, but trust me, it's important. Now what you want to do is to turn to the link between criminal interrogations and the substantive law. And again, what's been fascinating to me is that in the legal literature, and here I'm talking about cases as well as law review commentary, the link between procedure and substance is almost nowhere stated explicitly. Perhaps nowhere. I can't find it. The link is so powerful, I believe, that we've been able to take it completely for granted when fashioning our interrogation procedures. Okay, we have spent decades wringing our hands, right, over Miranda versus Arizona. So much ink has been spilled. So many words have been tossed and hurled over that opinion. At the end of the furor, The rules are bare bones, and they're very easily satisfied, okay? Give the suspect four simple warnings. Don't twist your arms too hard, and you're good to go. That's it. That's absolutely it, so far as the law is concerned. So all of that writing, and that's where we are, okay? Isn't that fabulous? But notice the obvious. You're good to go ahead and do what? It's so obvious, again, everyone knows the drill. You are good to go ahead, get the suspect to confess. Any confession you do get will be admissible in evidence. But the presence of the penal code is the condition precedent to the conversation, right? And so we would expect that the substantive law, by creating the occasion and the opportunity for this precise conversation, is going to condition, channel, shape the trajectory and content of the conversation. It also goes without saying, and I want to pause briefly on this subject, that officers are structuring their remarks so as to create the opportunity for suspects to give true admissions that will help them to prove the elements of the crime. It so completely goes without saying in the law review literature, as I said, that no one either says it or says anything about how it, that goal, is to be accomplished, with one telling exception. The cases and the commentary do insist that the police must avoid tactics that will produce a false confession. False in the important but fairly narrow sense of referring to a crime that the suspect did not commit or that was never committed at all. So false in that, again, significant but very narrow. The suspect admits he committed an action he never committed or that no one else committed. And so notice this, too. The problem and the opportunity for the project is that the only tactics that are understood to have this power to produce a false confession are physical violence and explicit promises of leniency. That leaves a lot of room for police to maneuver in creating the truth, and it's there in that room, in that space, where I'm doing this project. My question is, what are the police doing in there? What are they doing? So my initial impressions are formed when I followed the lead of the Supreme Court in Miranda and began to read police interrogation manuals. As the court in Miranda observes, we have very limited access to the interrogation room. Police discourage the presence of observers there. But let's start by looking at the training manuals. The training manuals don't give us a perfect window into that world, but they certainly provide a starting point for developing an empirical picture of what's happening in the interrogation room. In future research, and this is one of the empirical questions that many of my colleagues who are kindly enough to come and listen and get yet again to me rant and rave about these questions, I'm aiming in future research perhaps to develop more clear access to some of the empirical materials. For purposes of this project and for these remarks, I'm remaining within the confines of the how-to manuals, how to interrogate, interrogations for dummies, if you will. So the first book that I read was the text that's explicitly criticized, but ultimately and ironically tacitly endorsed by the court in Miranda. This book, it's entitled Criminal Interrogations and Confessions, was authored by the late Fred Inbau and John Reed. It's very famous in criminal procedure circles. I call it the Inbau book. The initial version is published in, the first edition is published in 1962. And I must have first read it in 1992, right, when I was teaching myself how to teach criminal procedure. So I picked it up in an effort to understand what was going on in there to give those nine Supreme Court justices such fits. What was going on in the interrogation room besides violence to make them react as strongly as they did to come out with this Miranda opinion? And what you find when you open the volume is a world of stories. It's a world of storytelling. It's a manual for how to run a story hour for suspects. It's just absolutely wonderful. It's full of remarkable stuff. There are all kinds of tricks and strategies. We've talked about some of these in class. You know, all these ruses that you can use to prime the confessional pump. But the primary advice is for the interrogator to tell the suspect stories and keep on telling him stories until he signs on to one of the stories as his true confession. And again, I want to be fairly precise and fine-grained. Speaking generally, but actually quite precisely, it boils down to this. Here's what you're supposed to do if you're an interrogator. Once you are reasonably convinced that this suspect is guilty, you should bring him in and sketch for him two or three, you may have to get on to four, but hopefully two or three will do it, two or three alternative stories. Each of the alternative stories is incriminating, but one will be less incriminating than others. One of the stories is going to offer a moral, notice it's a moral excuse, not a legal excuse, for the suspect's misconduct. And the notion is that upon hearing that version, that exculpatory version, the version that lets him off the hook morally, the suspect is going to feel comforted, going to feel less like an outsider, going to feel comforted and ultimately comfortable giving a full confession. So what the drill is for you to say, look, come on in here, fella. I know you are guilty. Okay, I have the evidence to prove it. Your goose is cooked. All the forensic evidence, eyewitnesses, everything. You are the one who did it. The only hope for you now, the only thing you can do to help yourself out is to talk to me and tell me why you did it. We want to have a complete picture of why you did it. So tell me, did you do this thing deliberately in a cold-blooded, planned, premeditated kind of way? Or was it just an accident? And the idea is that when you work with that sort of story, ultimately the suspect will raise his hand and go, oh, yeah, I did it. Okay. So there I am, right? It's 1992. I'm reading a book published in 1962, trying to gain insight into the history of Miranda so I can be a good criminal procedure teacher. What else is going on in my research at that time? I'm teaching criminal law, and I'm teaching feminist jurisprudence, so I'm starting to teach myself about the history of the rape reform movement and the emergence of the battered woman syndrome defense and other interesting domestic violence initiatives. So what is it that I find most striking about my first glimpse of the interrogation manuals? Well, they're very antiquated, right? They're just wonderful. You've got to read them. They're full of antiquated slang. You're going to encounter, you know, characters like gals and fellas, and the epithets are very mild. You know, the curse words seem to be nothing harsher than darn and heck and that kind of thing. They're also full of antiquated furniture. You find people still using typewriters and worrying about carbon copies getting smeared and using payphones, things like that. And likewise, when I came upon the rape interrogation stories that I'm about to describe, I thought, oh, they're also full of these antiquated stories about, again, placing the blame, police and perpetrators getting together and placing the blame for these crimes on rape victims. And I want to now describe some of these plot lines to you, again, so that you can think them through with me and hopefully give me your reactions. The most popular plot line, sponsored by the Inbow book, involves direct condemnation of the crime victim. Okay, so this is an across-the-board tactic. It's advised that you use it in every case, but almost all of their examples are taken from rape cases. And it is said to be the strategy of choice, the foolproof strategy for rape cases. But I want to instantly acknowledge and put before you that the police use it in a whole range of cases. It may be that there's nothing special about victim blaming in rape cases. It may be just another species of what they generally do. But here's what I found, at least what I was thinking back in 1992. We're encountering, right, precisely the same representation of the guilty rape victim that the feminist movement had been determined to overthrow and that had convinced state legislators to start expunging from penal codes and the formal definitions. So, for example, interrogators were encouraged to advise the suspect that his, quote, victim was to blame for dressing or behaving in such a way as to have unduly excited a man's passion. And here they provide, again, very precise script. You're to say, Joe, no woman should be on the street alone at night looking as sexy as she did. Even here today, here in the station house, she's got on a low-cut dress that makes visible damn near all her breasts. that's wrong. It's too much of a temptation for any normal man. If she hadn't gone around dressed like that, you wouldn't be in this room now. Other advice that the experts give, they advise officers to fault the victim for behaving in such a way as to arouse the suspect sexually to a point where he just had to have an outlet for his feelings. Again, very specific bits of dialogue are provided for the police to weave into their own interrogation scripts. The officers are counseled to say, "Joe, she was having a lot of fun for herself by letting you kiss her and feel her breast. For her, that would have been sufficient. But men aren't built the same way as women. There's a limit to the teasing and excitement they can take. Then something's got to give. A female ought to realize this, and if she's not willing to go all the way, she ought to stop way short of what this gal did to you." And then finally, where the circumstances permit, the officer should consider suggesting that the rape victim had acted like she might have been a prostitute, and the suspect had assumed she was a willing partner. And the books go on and say, by thus, quote, condemning and, quote, degrading the victim, the officer is going to make it easier for the suspect to admit the act of intercourse or at least his presence in her company at the time of the crime. Okay, so what did I just describe for you? I just described the victim-blaming stories that appeared in the pre-Miranda version of the leading text on police interrogation tactics. That's right. But here's the thing. Here's the rub, at least for me. Precisely the same stories appear in the most current edition. By now we're at the fourth edition, which was published in 2001. So exactly the same victim-blaming stories appear today. Again, how did I make this discovery? As part of my research for being a criminal procedure teacher, what you do is first you read the first edition of InBow. Then you read Miranda, or reread Miranda. Then you read the post-Miranda books to find out what impact Miranda had on police interrogation tactics. Now, what impact did Miranda have? Very little, it turns out. The advice, I mean, there's more red tape, but the advice is the same. It's the drill. Give the suspect four simple warnings. And get her to waive her rights. Get her to sign a waiver card. Do not twist her arms too hard. And you are good to go and do exactly what we told you to do in the first edition. So the underlying victim-blaming stories are exactly the same. And, of course, my concern, hence my project, is that during the decades when these books were being written, when the experts were dreadfully worried about the so-called Miranda Revolution, turns out that Miranda didn't have much impact, but then neither did the changes in the substantive law. During this same time frame, the substantive law had changed pretty dramatically, and certainly I've been teaching my students in feminist theory classes that it has changed. And yet, when I turn back to the interrogation manuals, it looks as though we are living in, back in 1962, as if the rape reform movement hasn't happened at all. What I expected to find was that the stories would have changed subtly, that there would have been subtle changes in the story. So to be completely honest, and in part because Rachel Harmon and I have a dispute going over whether this news story is of substantive significance, and I'm begging you to tell me which one of us is right, and I actually find myself hoping that it's Rachel, because it gives me some hope that we're seeing in advance. One story did change, okay? So in the first version published in 1962, we have one sort of rape-blaming story, victim-blaming story, and then in the new version, 2001, we have a new one. So in 1962, 67, 1986, the authors provide the following suggestion. One of the things they recommend throughout the books, and this is really interesting, I know none of you is ever going to get interrogated, but do not fall for this stuff, okay? I just can't help it. This is the defense in me. Please. Okay. They say, look, interrogators, it's very, very helpful for you to indicate to the suspect that you have a friend or relative who indulged in the same kind of conduct as that which is under investigation. Right? So just go ahead and basically say, you know, everybody's doing it. In some situations, they go on to say, it's even appropriate for the investigator himself or herself to acknowledge that he or she has been tempted to indulge in that behavior. And here is where they switch stories. Okay, so remember, that's the point in the text. You should indicate that your friends and relatives, and maybe you, have been tempted to indulge in this behavior. So the first version, again, published in 1962 and then carried over in 67 and 86. The case involved a young man, about 17 years of age, who was suspected of rape. The suspect was told that because of the circumstances of the case, he could hardly avoid doing what he did, and that, moreover, the interrogator himself, as a young man in high school, roughed it up with a girl in an attempt to have intercourse with her. Soon thereafter, the suspect confessed. His father arrived at the police station protesting his son's arrest. He was told his son had committed a rape and had admitted to it. The father vehemently protested that his son could not have done such a thing. When the interrogator learned of the protest, he advised the arresting officers to have the father meet his son face to face and learn the truth directly from the confessor himself. When the two met, the father said, "Son, did you do this?" The son replied, "Yes, Dad. I just couldn't help what I did. Even Mr. Interrogator did something like this when he was in high school." Fortunately, the suspect pleaded guilty, and in view of extenuating circumstances, was granted probation, which spared the interrogator the experience of testifying to what he had told the suspect. Now, I read that, obviously, and if I was teaching myself in 1992, and if my autobiography of my paper is accurate, and trust me, it is, that's the version that I read when I read the post-Miranda editions, because there it was. In the current edition, published in 2001, and it's here that Rachel Harmon and I have a dispute. I don't see that the new story is an advance over the old one. She claims that it is. I'm sure she knows much better than I do. In the current edition, this is published in 2001, again, exactly in the same place, the suspect will be encouraged to know that friends and relatives and even you have done similar things. Jim, I think that what happened here is that this gal came onto you in the bar and was flirting with you, leaving the clear impression that she was interested in a sexual relationship. But when it came down to it, she changed her mind at the last second. I've got a sister who used to get all dressed up and go to these singles bars. She'd pick a guy out and talk real intimately with him while he was buying her drinks. At the end of the evening, of course, the guy would try to get her alone in his car or apartment. She usually ended up driving herself home, which obviously made the guy pretty upset. I think in your situation, this gal allowed the relationship to get much closer than what my sister did, and we both know guys reach a certain point of no return. It's hard for me to see the development in that plot. But what Rachel Harmon has pointed out to me, and I'm struggling to see if I agree and to see if this is reason for applause, what Rachel says is that the old story provided a motive for rough sex, and the new story provides merely a motive for consensual sex. And that, in fact, there is a significant difference between the two. We no longer see officers providing motives for roughing girls up, but motives for consensual sex, and we should look at that as a development. It's difficult for me to do this, and so I need help. Okay, so I want to now give you what I think and hope the payoffs from the paper are likely to be. First, I want to publish the observation. Okay, there's nothing in the law literature about the rhetorical narrative strategies that the police are using. I want to publish the observation, and I want to explicitly pay homage to the genius of the police. They are doing a wonderful job. They know exactly as we do that law is an enterprise where the truth is constructed by narratives, by stories. And they have developed sensible yet sophisticated strategies that rely on what psychologists, I'm thinking here of the work of Jerome Bruner, calls folk psychology. And they're using this folk psychology to persuade suspects to confess to crimes that otherwise might go unresolved. Right? And here I have in mind, of course, comments by Justice Jackson. How important do you think confessions are? If you think that confessions are going to be important in solving a small category of cases, or maybe a large category of cases that otherwise would go unresolved, well, then we're all for it. We want to have a reasonable process of police interrogation. And likewise, as Bruner explains, what the police are doing is exploiting perfectly the distinction between sort of moral exculpation and legal culpability, right? They are trying to provide the suspect comfort and explanation for his deviant behavior that brings him back into the fold, makes it comfortable, gives him the comfort of telling a story that will allow him to confess, provide a mitigating, but only in a moral sense, explanation. Bruner never points to the police interrogation manuals. I'm going to email him and tell him that he should look at them because they are a perfect example of the folk psychology that he has in mind. And, of course, the police don't cite the work of Bruner or any other psychologists. And I've lately become persuaded that they don't need to because they are, in fact, doing the precise folk psychology that provides the basis for the academics' work. So they are geniuses at what they're doing, and we should applaud them. On the other hand, I also want to develop a much more nuanced understanding of the role that police play in finding the historical facts of crimes, particularly in the police confessional. And in trying to come up with a more fine-grained description of what it is that police are doing, I've been thinking about various analogies. We tend to think of law as a realist discourse, right? Realist in the sense that there's truth out there somewhere, right? A crime occurred. It occurred at time one. We want the police to run around and find the facts, to gather the physical clues and facts, historical clues that bring that truth to light. They don't make those clues up, right? They find them. And that's what we expect them to do. Now, in the interrogation room, it becomes a little more complicated because those facts are hidden in the hearts and the minds, the heads of suspects. But nonetheless, the facts are still there. There are true facts that the skillful investigator can find. And so what I've been trying to do is to think about what exactly is the role of the interrogator. How should we think about it? And one of my favorite was offered by Justice Frankfurter in a case decided several years before Miranda. It's Cologne versus Connecticut, which is an incredibly fractured court. There's like, you know, six different opinions. Frankfurter uses the analogy of midwife. So he compares the interrogator to a midwife, okay? And so what he says is, you know, he doesn't like confessions. He's criticizing the police interrogations. But he says a confession may be, a confession made by a person in custody is not always the result of an overborne will. The police may be midwife to a declaration naturally born of remorse, relief, desperation, or calculation. If that is so, if the suction process has not been at the prisoner, then it's okay. We should allow the confession. The midwife analogy, it didn't work then. Okay, only Justice Stewart signed on to Frankfurter's opinion, so they didn't work for the those guys then. It's certainly not going to work for the justices today. And as I think my way through this problem, it doesn't work for me either. Again, the notion that you can just stand back and sort of naturally have the words flow out. Certainly, I don't want them to use some awful suction process, as Frankfurter says. You know, maybe we shouldn't let them use forceps to sort of mangle or mash or maul the factual baby, whatever it is. But nonetheless, the midwife metaphor doesn't seem to be appropriate to me. Though it's absolutely fascinating to see that the justices once considered it and relied on it. The analogy that's coming out of my paper is a much more active one, and it's playwright. It's collaborative playwright. It's storyteller, collaborative storyteller. The notion being that we do not say to the police, you can only do a deposition, straightforward Q&A. Did you do it? No. Okay. We allow a much more full-blown conversation in which the police are actively encouraged to talk, to get a conversation going. And the metaphor that I see coming out here is playwright, and I'm happy to live with that. But this brings me back around to the two of the larger questions that worry me. One is, what should the scripts be, right? This is the normative question, and I don't yet have an answer to this question, but what should the interrogation scripts be in rape cases and in criminal cases more generally? I don't yet have a conclusive answer, never will. That's one of the great joys of being a scholar, is always getting to revise and improve our own work as well as we hope that of others. But I do have some strong intuitions and then some speculations for future research. It strikes me that victim blaming in rape cases, no matter where it occurs, whether it's the courtroom, the station house, the press, private conversations, you know, has the potential to reinforce sexist stereotypes that blame women for being raped and that relieve their attackers of culpability for the crimes. Today we call these stereotypes, right? But as an historical matter, and I thank my colleague Barbara Armacost for helping me think through the historical connections, as an historical matter, these stereotypes were real. You know, as I explored in my paper called Sex and Guilt on the origins of rape law, these tales about women's culpability for sex and sexual violence did so much work in the law specifically that the elements of rape really shifted the burden of proof to the woman. She had to prove that she had forcibly resisted forcible sex. This was her way of excusing herself for having sex outside of marriage. So certainly as an historical matter, our police, our prosecutors, judges, juries, you know, as well as those rascally defense lawyers, they were inclined to believe that women who complained of rape had asked for it, and the legal burden was placed on them to show that that was not true. And my intuition, again, having been raised in a generation, we were in fact taught this wisdom. My intuition is that women internalized these messages as well and came to blame themselves for rapes. My strong intuition, again, here I don't have a real clear empirical case to make, is that people continue to believe the rape victim blaming scripts. In the philosophical, in contemporary philosophical literature and in contemporary psychological literature, the consensus seems to be that one of the unique injuries of rape, what sets rape apart from other forms of assault, is precisely the fact that the victim blames herself, or I should add himself, for the crime having occurred. Alan Wertheimer, who's a philosopher at the University of Vermont, who writes a lot about law-related questions, excuses, justifications, and the like, has recently published a monograph on rape. And again, he makes this argument very clearly that this is the unique problem with rape. This is why rape is different from, worse than, other forms of assaults. So this is my intuition. With that said, right, the response from the police, it's going to be, we need these stories. We need them to catch rape. We have to get suspects in and ask them how the crime went down. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to close the cases. We're going to have to send the victim home, and no one is going to go to jail. And they'll say, we don't believe these stories. You criminal procedure types, you know full well that we are full of tricks, strategies, deception, and this is just another form of bait that we use to trick suspects into confessing. We do not believe these stories, and in fact, we are deploying them in ways that serve very precisely the ends of the feminist reform movement because we are helping to catch and punish rapists. This is a very powerful argument, and it's one that I have to reckon with very carefully. My intuition is that if we accept this assessment of costs and benefits, we might decide that we're going to live with these stories, at least in some cases. We still ought to acknowledge that part of my hypothetical police response, it itself is false, or at least partially false. People do believe the rape victim blaming script. This is exactly why the police use them. They are offering moral excuses for misconduct. And again, the law may not recognize that moral excuse, but the police are exploiting the fact that people do indeed believe these scripts. And they use them to provide some moral comfort. I think we would have to acknowledge that people believe them, but nonetheless, that at a cost, it's worth the offsetting benefit. But then I think I have two thoughts that I'll leave you with. One is, it seems to me that there is a category of cases in which the use of the rape blaming script is problematic and harmful, in the sense that it is handing the suspect a legal and not merely moral excuse. And that is the difficult category of acquaintance rape cases that prosecutors throughout the country, and in the military too, I should add, are struggling to prosecute today. The rape victim blaming script that emerges from these old interrogation tactics was developed in an era where we had the common law definition of the crime, right? So under the common law definition, what was required by those statutory elements was a very violent sex act. You had to have a lot of violence exercised by the perpetrator and physical resistance exercised by the victim. The police problem in these stories, of course, is suspects denying that they were there. They had nothing to do with it. They were elsewhere. They had an alibi. So the claim was, I didn't have sex, period, full stop. Well, by whistling the guy in and telling him the victim-blaming story and perhaps getting him to concede because he feels comforted or whatever, I did it. Well, that is a significant gain in law enforcement because, in fact, when we measure the victim-blaming script that might emerge from the interrogation room against the physical facts of the crime, the victim-blaming story is going to collapse completely. In fact, it will make the suspect look even more evil. The sex was so violent that no one but a very evil person would believe that it was consensual. Okay? The problem today is that we have another category of cases that are much more difficult to try and that they are very different. The suspect is not contesting the fact that the sex occurred. He concedes that it occurred. His claim is it was consensual. Right? So at that point, if you use the victim-blaming scripts, including some of the ones that I read to you that the police are continuing to endorse, you may in fact be giving the suspect a legal defense. And it's here I think, why are they doing the job for the defense lawyers? Because in fact what they're saying to the guy is, you honestly believed she was consenting by her conduct, by kissing you, and so forth. This was foreplay, right? I mean, that's the way it goes. And so in that category of cases, I think the police probably should ditch the victim-blaming story, come up with alternative ones. The problem is that the alternatives I can think of are not very pretty either, but I'll leave that for another day. So it's clear to me that in acquaintance rape cases, we should get rid of them. The other thing I want to say, and this brings me back around to the very large question that's lurking at the back of the project and really has to be an epilogue for now, is again this question of the connection between the substantive law of the books and police interrogation practices. Here's what worries me when I read the interrogation manuals. I haven't read all of them, but I have read a ton, and so have my poor research assistants. We've been reading these things until, you know, we really could interrogate people to do it. Okay, so we've read tons of them, and many of them focus on rape. Rape and homicide, those are the big crimes where interrogation takes place. And when you look at the world, it's not just the Inbal books, but the whole world, you really don't get any sense that the substantive law has been reformed significantly. So I find myself occasionally wondering, well, maybe it hasn't been. Maybe I'm overstating the reforms, you know, when I describe the events in criminal law or in feminist jurisprudence. But you get no sense that the law has been revised. They all are speaking about forcible, violent rape. We've tried hard to get access to actual police training manuals. Again, just as the court found in Miranda, the police are reluctant to let you come into the room. They're even reluctant to share with a law professor their interrogation manuals. We can't get the paper from them easily. But what worries me is, do they not know that the law of rape has changed very dramatically? In some states, as I said, a simple verbal no can suffice to prove that this was a rape. In the most cutting-edge definitions, rape occurs in the absence of affirmative permission. Well, clearly the police, say when they're developing probable cause, need to know that the law has changed. Otherwise, they're not going to ask the victim the right questions, right? If she comes in and they say, well, did he rough you up? And she says, no, they're just going to send her home. And there isn't a hint or a glimmer in the interrogation manuals that they're aware that these law changes have occurred. In fact, when we called the police in New Jersey recently, they're one of the jurisdictions I'm most interested in because they have one of the most expansive definitions of rape. The wonderful Michelle Morris librarian said, well, she's interested because, you know, you guys have a really forward-looking definition of rape. And the guy said, what? I mean, we have no idea what that what meant, but that's what we want to know. So, again, this question of the disconnect, do they know the law on the books? How do they learn it? would have very profound implications for criminal procedure practices, you know, as they are the gatekeepers to the people who come into the system. So I guess I will leave it there, and thank you so much for coming and listening to me on this wonderful day.